You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Tom Michaels, sitting in for Gemma Gaudette. Well, we closed out May with some interesting headlines, and joining us for our Friday Reporters Roundtable are Betsy Russell, Boise Bureau Chief with the Idaho Press Tribune, Kevin Richard, a reporter with Idaho Education News, and Bill Manny, Community Engagement Editor with the Idaho Statesman. Welcome to you all.
Thanks.
Thanks. Hello.
So let's jump in. State House leadership is suggesting that Governor Otter consider calling a special legislative session to address issues of flood control on Idaho rivers and reservoirs. And Treasure Valley water users have been tangling with state officials for years. So what is the disagreement? Why is flood control, Betsy, contentious enough to call a special session?
Well, the question is about water rights. And water rights are always highly contentious in Idaho. And in this case, the question is, when water is released early in the season for flood control, does that actually satisfy the water rights of those who are downstream waiting for that water to use it to irrigate when it's released too early for them to use it? And the state has taken the position that, yes, it does. The water users, of course, have said, no, we don't think it does. And there's a court case, a very complicated court case, pending right now at the Idaho Supreme Court. But there are also hot and heavy efforts to settle this issue, as has been done in some other parts of the state. And I think we're going to find out a lot more about this issue next week when a special joint meeting of the House and Senate Resources Committee is scheduled on exactly this issue. Legislative leaders who've been working on the settlement have been saying that they believe the governor should call a special session of the legislature this summer to enact legislation to support the settlement that's in the works, but we don't know yet whether the governor will do that or not.
So it's a dispute over water, not enough early on, too much later on, and also, who are the winners? Who are the losers in this potential battle?
Well, you know, the old saying in Idaho, of course, is that water runs uphill toward money. And so the irrigators who rely on this water have a huge financial stake. If you can't water your crops when you need to, they will fail. At the same time, that same water could be used for power generation, recreation, other uses. Left in the reservoirs, there are people on all sides of this issue who have a stake in it.
The other adage is whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. So Senate President Pro Tem Brent Hill, a Republican from Rexburg, said in an email to fellow senators, quote, "I am sorry to have to tell you about the special session, but very grateful for the finalization of an agreement on this important issue." Now, of course, this session hasn't been called yet. What are the chances?
I think the chances are actually pretty good. We do have a history in Idaho of, on occasion, having very brief special sessions on very specific issues. A special session could last for even just a few hours.
So, Tom, I was going to ask Betsy if the case is going to go to the Supreme Court on June 20th, can they get a special session scheduled and conducted in time to foreclose the Supreme Court case?
I don't think so. And I did see a report from Bill Spence in the Lewiston Tribune this week saying that if there is a special session, the thinking is that that wouldn't occur until July or August. So
right.
I think they're going to let what happens in court play out. But what happens in court could be affected by these settlement talks. And so it may be that both the settlement talks and the court action are dependent then on something that would come out of a special session after that.
Bill Manny?
Well, we've been managing water this way for 30 years, so I think there's a lot of skepticism that somehow we now need a legislative session to settle this after many, many years of agreement on how to handle it. I've also heard it described as kind of a manufactured crisis, and so I'm skeptical, and I'm not as sanguine as Betsy that this will all happen. Governor Otter has in the past said that he wanted to let this play out in the courts, and I was doing some research, and Rocky Barker, you know, wrote about this in 2015 and was making some of these very same arguments. So I still have not understood why it's an emergency that we have to deal with in such an extraordinary step.
And speaking of extraordinary steps, Kevin, there are other times when the legislator has called this special session. Over what types of issues?
We've had a very kind of interesting past with special sessions because, as Betsy points out, it's the governor's prerogative and exclusively the governor's prerogative to call a special session. So it's really up to Governor Otter to decide in the final few months of his time that this is an issue that has risen to the level where it has to be dealt with this summer in an executive session, in an extraordinary session. Probably the most high-profile example of a governor using the power to call an extraordinary session was Jim Risch in his very brief time as governor, his seven-month time as governor, brought the legislature in town for one day to overhaul the way we pay for public schools, the way taxes flow to public schools, and it has had far-reaching implications for public school finance in the ensuing 12 years. So these can be a really big deal. I mean, just because it's a one-day session, a one-issue session, does not diminish the potential for big policy can happen in these short sessions.
You're in tune with Idaho Matters. This is our Friday Reporters Roundtable. We're speaking with Kevin Richard, Betsy Russell, and Bill Manny. And we'd like to hear from you. You can reach us via email at idahomatters@boisestate.edu, on Twitter at KBSX915, or on our Facebook page, Boise State Public Radio. Well, we have some breaking news, and I'll go back to you, Kevin. Last time you were on this program, you said that the interim for Boise State University to replace retiring Bob Kustra will probably be someone in the administration. Well, we just learned that it was someone in the former administration. Who is it?
Well, first of all, it wouldn't be a Friday Reporter Roundtable without the latest comings and goings in university presidents, right? So what the State Board did today was name an interim president at Boise State, and it's Martin Shimp, who had been provost at the university for quite some time. So really what this boils down to is you're going to kind of operate the university and sort of kind of keep the wheels on the bus during this process of finding a new and permanent president. And that's a process that's really going to be worth watching because, you know, this is round two for the State Board trying to find a permanent successor to Bob Kustra. After several months and $100,000, no permanent candidate emerged. So we start over again.
It's round two for the search for Boise State, but it's round three, four, or five for, you know, Idaho higher education. We just went through selection process for Idaho State University, for Lewis Clark State College. Now we have Chuck Staben announcing or maybe not announcing but acknowledging that he won't be back as president. So this is kind of a remarkable moment for Idaho higher education, and I haven't been here – but about 15 years, but I can't remember a time when there was, felt like there was so much turmoil and tumult at the very top of our higher education apparatus.
When I wrote about it last fall, when the State Board was in the process of looking for new presidents at Idaho State University, Lewis Clark State College, and those have been filled, and Bob Kustra had announced his retirement, so you had these three vacancies, I couldn't find any longtime observers, people who've been around here longer than me, and there are those people, who could say that there was ever a time when the state was looking for three university presidents at the same time. Now you're looking to fill a fourth within a very short window of time. It is a historic turnover.
And just a quick note on Marty Shimp. He joined the faculty in 1990, and one of his accomplishments was helping to build out the graduate school program. And in 2016, that effort led to a long-sought prize, Boise State being classified as a, quote, doctoral research institution by the Carnegie Classification Group. He will stay on as interim. Betsy.
Well, I think that it makes sense that the State Board would turn to someone from within the university, someone known, someone trusted, to kind of keep things on keel during this time of turmoil. There was a time when the University of Idaho needed an interim president, and they turned to Don Burnett, the dean of the University of Idaho College of Law. So I think this is a reasonable and expected choice, and probably some are breathing a sigh of relief that some stability has been brought to this process during the interim.
I think a safe choice, too. He was provost and vice president for academic affairs, which, you know, signals that they want someone who's going to pay attention to the education side of things. Interestingly, though, he had just announced that he was going to be stepping down from administration and go back to teaching. So it's his second 180-degree turn in not very many months. The other thing I was going to mention, Tom, is just not only do you have so many openings and so much change at the top of our higher education leadership, but it's just the way it's happened. This the failed search for the for Boise State, and now the Staben essentially being forced out, controversy over the selection at ISU. It really does feel like something happening beyond just a lot of turnover, but something really dramatic.
And let's get one more thing in there. Kevin, you reported that University of Idaho Athletic Director Rob Spears' 60-day leave has been extended. What's the status?
He's on permanent administrative leave as the university continues this internal investigation into sexual misconduct complaints within the athletic department. And this is a story that Chad Kripe at the Statesman has done some really remarkable work breaking down. Yeah, and it depends on how you look at this issue as far as whether that's a factor in Chuck Staben's departure. He denies that the investigation had anything to do with his departure. The timing is still significant, however.
I do think that the Spear uncertainty just contributes to this whole sense of being unsettled and rudderless in higher education right now. It contributes to that turmoil that we were talking about.
So we continue our Friday Reporters Roundtable. Again, joining me in the studio, Betsy Russell, the Idaho Press Tribune, Kevin Richard, Idaho Education News, and Bill Manny with the Idaho Statesman. So, Bill, last week, very interesting, you wrote a piece about a school bus driver in Emmett who allegedly abused a student and how public record laws prevented accountability in these types of cases. And earlier this week, as an update, the Emmett Independent School District released video of the incident to the Statesman. First, catch our listeners up on the incident itself.
Okay, so there was an allegation that a bus driver had abused a 9-year-old student physically and verbally, and the parents filed a complaint with the police. And actually, the parents viewed the video that was taken on the bus and then wanted it released so the public could see it. Our reporter, Katie Mueller, filed a public records request and was denied for privacy, essentially. And so my point, and as a longtime Idaho journalist, it's very frustrating to try to get government to release public records, and they have the power to say no, which forces all of us to go to court or at least hire a lawyer to force release of public records. So ultimately, the Emmett School District did release the video. The superintendent disagreed with both having to release it and our decision to publish the video. And understandably, people are concerned about what's going to happen to a 9-year-old child who's been the subject of that kind of treatment and the video? So I can sympathize with the superintendent.
Well, let's share what the superintendent said. That's Emmett Independent School District Superintendent Wayne Rush. He said, quote, "In my opinion, the Idaho Statesman has not shown appropriate restraint in protecting the privacy rights of a 9-year-old child. In your article on the issue, you identify him as having disabilities and even listed a diagnosis," end quote. So here's a question. Did the Statesman show, quote, appropriate restraint?
So those details were released before the video was released. The child's parent described in describing the child talked about the challenges that the child faced. So that was already out there before the video was released. I don't think it's up to the school superintendent to decide what a parent can or can't say about their child. It's a tough decision. It's a horrible position for a parent or an administrator to be in. But ultimately, public records are public. And if you deny access to public records, then we can't judge as citizens of our state whether the leadership of our school district or the bus are handling it appropriately. So tough decision, hard issue, but it's not up to the superintendent ultimately to decide what a parent can or can't say about their child.
When you editorialized, it was almost as if you described it as a, quote, tax on newspaper groups, journalists.
Or citizens. You know, when a city or a school district or the state or a county denies those public records, we're forced to go to a lawyer. So you're having to pay hundreds, if not thousands of dollars for routine access to public records. It's something that we've all faced. I know Idaho Education News and Betsy's publications, and it's Idaho has a toothless public records law, and that was part of my frustration. I called it a delay and deny law because it puts the burden on citizens and journalists to get a lawyer and go to court to face mm-hmm. release of public records.
And I maybe kick over to Betsy Russell here. You relayed a story to KUER, that's the public radio station in Salt Lake City, about Idaho imposing a sales tax on public records. How would you explain that?
I thought that was a really odd one. So I was contacted by a reporter in Utah with a public radio station who made a public records request to the Pocatello Police Department and was informed that in addition to the fees that he would be charged $8 in sales tax. And he asked, have you ever heard of this? I said, no. For one thing, we don't even impose our sales tax on services in general in Idaho, let alone on government services. And the Idaho Public Records Act says specifically that only the actual cost of copying and providing the records may be charged. Turns out the state tax commission had been reading the law to say that perhaps this could be charged, but they thought about it and thought that wasn't a very good idea, so they're going to propose legislation to make clear that you cannot charge that. But I guess I would differ with Bill just a little bit. I don't think that Idaho's public records law is toothless. It could use a few more teeth. And I just got back from the road. I was up in North Idaho this week with Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin and Deputy Attorney General Brian Kane conducting seminars on the Public Records Act and the Open Meeting Law and how to comply with them. And it's clear that we need some strengthening of our laws, but we have seen some strengthening of them, and they do have some important features that if everyone complies with them, really promote public access in Idaho.
Kevin Richard, what do you think? Does this law have teeth?
There's teeth to it, and we use it effectively. I think all three of us on this panel have used it effectively in the past. We're constantly at Idaho Ed News in this process of seeking records. Sometimes it is a very adversarial process, however. We had a dispute with the Sugar-Salem School District in eastern Idaho. We felt that their process of hiring a new superintendent was not transparent. We fought them on the records issue, and we had a trustee say in a public meeting that perhaps what the district should do is get a restraining order against Idaho Education News reporters to keep them from being such a hassle. And you know, that's not how it works in public sphere. That's not within the dominion of an elected official to say, you know, if we just got a restraining order against that reporter, all of our problems would magically go away.
So problems won't go away,
and neither will we.
Kevin, you obviously know about the nuance of dealing with minors because you report on education issues. I want to remind our listeners that they're listening to Idaho Matters. Tom Michaels sitting in for Gemma Gaudette here. We're talking to Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, Betsy Russell, Idaho Press Tribune, and Bill Manny from the Idaho Statesman. And I did want to move along, and Betsy, you reported on a lawsuit filed by four Idaho women against the state of Idaho, charging living will, are discriminatory toward pregnant women. And we'll be talking with one of the plaintiffs in that suit later this show. But if you could you unpack the gist of this suit?
Sure. This lawsuit was just filed yesterday, and I think it came as kind of a surprise to a lot of people in Idaho. We didn't know that was in our living will law, that our living will law says if a person is pregnant, their living will is invalid, unenforceable. And so the lawsuit says, well, that's unconstitutional. And I remember this law has been on the books for over a decade. Back in 2005 when it first passed, I don't remember it being controversial at all. And I looked it up. It was unanimous in both houses, but there was no mention of that clause in the law. I even spoke with one of the floor sponsors of the bill at the time, and he didn't remember that clause. And that law at the time was combining some existing laws that were on the books. I think that's been in there for a very long time. A number of other states have it, and a number of them have also been sued.
Like what?
The state of Connecticut just repealed the law this year. The state of Washington was sued over this in 1984. And although the suit was thrown out on other grounds, the state of Washington then repealed the law. I'm guessing it's been buried in our laws for a very long time. And that this lawsuit actually will cause it to be rooted out of there.
Do you think it's one of those then anachronistic, under-the-radar kind of laws that you find on these books, or perhaps more intentional?
Well, I mean, I think there is some intent to it, and there was a very high-profile case in 2014 in Texas, which is one of the other 9 states that has this law right now, in which a woman who was brain dead, who was 14 weeks pregnant, her family, including her grieving husband and her own directives, didn't want her to be kept on a ventilator, and the hospital refused to take her off, citing that state law. Even though the fetus was not viable, there was a two-month-long court fight. The husband sued the hospital for what he called cruel and obscene mutilation of his wife's corpse. The judge finally said, this person is dead. The state law can't force her to be kept alive. That law in Texas, however, is still on the books.
We'd like to jump back into some education news. This week, the Coeur d'Alene Press reported North Idaho's Lakeland School District will place armed guards at Athol Elementary School this summer. And Betsy, you posted a piece that said Lakeland Joint School District Assistant Superintendent Lisa Sexton says the district's ultimate goal is to have an armed guard at each of the schools. District's 11 schools.
And in that case, that was in addition to the existing school resource officers who apparently are not armed there. But I think this is just a piece of a larger debate over safety in our schools. And we have a lot of differences of opinion in Idaho about whether we should be arming teachers, whether there should be guns at schools. We even had a recent incident in Pocatello at which the sheriff had to advise parents, don't bring guns to a school lockdown,
right,
because that's what they had done.
Kevin.
A common theme that I find with the Lakeland story and with what we've seen in other school districts is the concern about response time. The superintendent, the assistant superintendent at Lakeland was talking about a 911 call to that elementary school that took 22 minutes to get emergency response to the school. So that brings that gives rise to the idea of having an armed guard on campus. That gives rise to the idea of having an SRO on some campuses. And when you look at the school districts that have decided to arm staff, which you can do under Idaho state law, and some districts are already doing it, the common thread here is school districts or charter schools that are remote, that are far away from first responders, who feel like in an emergency situation, we need to be able to respond in-house in real time, as opposed to waiting for law enforcement to arrive. So that's why you see like the Garden Valleys of the world talking about arming staff as opposed to, say, the Boise School District.
So, Kevin, do you think this will be a new normal then in these rural districts? Do you think it'll spread even further?
I think you've probably got districts all over the state and charter schools all over the state really having to rethink what their first response is going to be, what their plan of action is going to be if the unthinkable happens. I mean, if administrators aren't having those conversations in-house, I'd be very surprised.
You got to sympathize with those administrators who have to make these kind of decisions. It's pretty tough.
These are tough decisions.
And it affects voters, too, because Lakeland is using money from a supplemental tax levy approved by voters to pay for this armed guard.
Well, I'd like to thank Bill Manny of the Idaho Statesman, Kevin Richard of Idaho Education News, and Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press Tribune. Thank you to you all.